Hello, this is Atta Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for this Tuesday, November 11th, 2025, coming to you from my home studio. And we thank all veterans on this Veterans Day. Thank you for your service. This edition of the Herald and Review is Veterans Day 2025, Saluting Veterans. I will say, looking through the edition, it is an abbreviated paper. There doesn't appear to be a sports section, so we'll just fill in where we can. We'll start on the front page, Military Freedom Isn't Free. Iraq War Veteran Speaks to Mount Zion High School Students. This article is by Valerie Wells, Mount Zion. When an IED exploded under the vehicle Chad Watson was riding in, he didn't even realize at first that he'd been injured. It was November 29, 2006, and Watson, a 2001 graduate of Mount Zion High School, was serving in the U.S. Marine Corps in Fallujah, Iraq, when the IED, improvised explosive device, rolled under the vehicle. When he tried to get out, he realized his right leg had been blown off above the knee. His left leg was damaged. He had shrapnel in his face. My guys ended up pulling me out, and that's when I realized my right leg was gone above the knee, Watson said. He spent 22 months in military hospitals, Bethesda and Walter Reed, for amputation rehab. He continued to work and study while he was in the hospital, and today works in logistics and supply chain in the Chicago area. His then-girlfriend, now his wife, stood by him, and they have three children. Watson told his story to the students at Mount Zion High School on Monday during a Veterans Day assembly, which history teacher Rich Hansen organizes every 4 years to inspire students and cultivate an appreciation for the sacrifices military men and women have made to ensure their freedom. I don't want it to go stale, Hansen said, of the reasoning for only having the event every 4 years. If the students in high school attend such an event every year, he said, he fears they would think, oh, it's the Veterans Day Assembly, and it wouldn't have the same impact. Norman Ross served in the U.S. Army in Vietnam in the 1st Infantry Division, 26th Regiment, of the Blue Spaders, and he said the program meant a lot to him. He served from March 1966 to March 1967, where the grass grew really green, Ross said of his time in Vietnam, where the spiders were big and the scorpions were all colors. That's just the way it was. Watson told students that if any of them are considering the military after graduation, that they can rest assured that their community and the veterans who have served before them will stand with them. He credits Mount Zion with support during his recovery and said he wouldn't have survived and thrived as well as he has if not for family, friends, and community. The Marines was the only service I ever looked at, Watson said. I had buddies in the Marine Corps, and that was the direction I chose. I wanted to be the best. It's the finest fighting force out there. It's important to celebrate veterans, said Solomon Peck, a senior. What they did and the sacrifice they made is beautiful, Peck said. Our freedom is not free, and they put their lives on the line every day so we'd have a chance to be free. Jay Oliveira, a senior who performed with the vocal ensemble during the program, was born in Brazil and came to the United States in 2017. His parents are veterans, he said, who served in Brazil during the war with Argentina, but patriotism isn't the same there as it is here. It's the importance of something larger, something bigger than yourself, Oliveira said. The things that these people went through, the things that they did, we can only study about. We can never understand the weight of the experience that they have surmounted. And I think that it's a beautiful thing to study and to commemorate the courage that they have. We are here today because of the sacrifices they have made in the past, and if I could only participate in a percentage in this event to thank the veterans for what they have done, what they have gone through for us, for our nation, I think it's extremely important. and I am so profoundly grateful to have been a part of it. Some photos that accompany the article here. Small color photo. Veterans Randy Janes, Carnell Bond, and Danny Humphrey talked to each other following the Mount Zion High School Veterans Day assembly on Monday, November 10th. And all three men appeared to be older than 60, maybe in 70s, 80s. All three standing with a bit of sunlight shining on them in the banquet area. And Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. Larger color photo here. Chad Watson is presented with a flag by Quincy Peterson from the High School Honor Guard after speaking in the Veterans Day Assembly at Mount Zion High School on Monday, November 10th. And we're seeing Peterson, the high school student, is standing with his back to the camera on the left, and he's in his military honor guard apparel. He has in his hand what we're seeing, the back of the frame of the triangular case with the flag. He's holding it with white gloves and presenting it to Chad Watson. And Watson, we see his full face and a smile, and his hands are on the frame accepting it. And there is a red curtain in the background. And finally, the largest photo here. It's a large color photo. Army veteran Bob Dondeville stands for the retrieval of the colors at the end of the Veterans Day assembly at Mount Zion High School on Monday, November 10th. He's wearing his beret, 475 Illinois, with Lincoln on top. And he appears to be over 60, maybe over 70, wearing a jacket, a sport coat, sweater, red, white, and blue tie, and button-down blue shirt. Joseph Ressler, photos, Herald and Review. Moving on to the local section, residents displaced in apartment fire Sunday. This is on page A2. Scott Perry, Decatur, has this article. The Red Cross is assisting occupants of two Decatur apartments damaged by fire Sunday night. The Decatur Fire Department said in a news release that it was called at approximately 10:20 p.m. to report of a fire in a third-floor apartment at 2700 North Monroe Street. Engine 5 proceeded into the building to investigate and to begin extinguishment. The next arriving crews assisted with stretching a hose line into the building and up to the third floor, the news release said. Other crews worked to assist residents in the immediate area with sheltering in place until the fire was contained. The fire was quickly extinguished and crews remained on scene, checking for extension and hot spots for some time. The release said one occupant was treated and transported to a local hospital for a medical issue unrelated to the fire. No other injuries were reported. Two apartments were declared uninhabitable. Man gets probation for exposure. Tony Reed, Decatur, has this article. A serial window peeper who exposed himself to a Decatur woman as she looked out her bathroom window has been sentenced to 30 months probation. Scott E. Palin, 38, appeared November 5th in Macon County Circuit Court and took a plea deal that saw him admit a charge of disorderly conduct for window peeping and a further count of public indecency lewd exposure. Judge Jeffrey Geisler also sentenced him to 90 days in the Macon County Jail, but agreed to stay the custodial sentence as part of the deal negotiated by defense attorney William Vig. Palin's criminal record shows previous convictions dating to March and June of 2005 for peering in the windows of women victims in Sangamon County. And in August of 2007, he was convicted of the offense again and sentenced to 30 months probation. He was arrested in Decatur in March of 2024 after a female victim in an apartment building in the 2400 block of North Water Street had been alarmed and frightened by Palin and ran into the street screaming for help. Decatur Police Department reports described Palin as earlier having knocked on all the windows of her apartment, and when the woman looked outside through her window, her bathroom window, she saw Palin pulling his pants down and exposing himself to her. Passing sentence, Geisler also ordered the defendant to undergo sex offender treatment as part of his probation conditions. A further condition of probation also warns Palin to stay away from and have no contact with the female victim of his Decatur crimes. Here's an interesting article. Lincoln's letter touted valet. John O'Connor, Associated Press, Springfield, Illinois. The short, handwritten note is a typical letter of reference for a man seeking a job, but the author is the President of the United States. It is also 1861, and the job seeker is a black man. Abraham Lincoln penned the entreaty on behalf of his young friend, William Johnson, because, ironically, his dark complexion caused freed black White House staffers with lighter skin to shun him. The difference of color between him and the other servants is the cause of our separation, Lincoln wrote in the March 16, 1861 letter that private collector Peter Tuit donated in August to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, where it is now on public display. The letter's recipient, Navy Secretary Gideon Welles, reported he had no position available. For a president in the mid-19th century to show such personal concern for a black man's welfare is astounding, but consider that Lincoln was fewer than 2 weeks removed from his inauguration, taking over a country rent by secession on the brink of a bloody civil war. The brief missive contains layer upon layer of revelations about Lincoln's presidential debut, said Christina Shute, executive director of the Library and Museum. We see him trying to help a friend. We see that even the new president cannot casually hand out jobs, Shute said. We see issues of class and color within the White House. Little is known about Johnson before he started work in 1859 as a valet and driver for Lincoln in Springfield. He traveled to Washington with the president-elect. Lincoln referred to the then 28-year-old Johnson in letters as a colored boy, but the individual favor he bestowed on Johnson was characteristic of the great emancipator, said James Conroy, a retired Massachusetts attorney and historian whose books include A Survey of Lincoln's White House. Lincoln treated the White House staff, largely made up of freed African Americans, with respect. In a separate article on the subject, Conroy wrote that Lincoln never demanded service, but he asked staffers politely and let them bear no hardship he could lift. Nobody can question that Lincoln was a very kindly guy, very empathetic, trying to help people when he could, Conroy told the Associated Press, and that crossed black and white and male and female and everything else. He was a genuinely good guy. It wasn't until November that Lincoln found Johnson a position at the Treasury Department. Lincoln maintained a close working relationship with Johnson, paying him to shave the president daily and often act as chauffeur. Well, this headline isn't much of a surprise, I would say, but it reads, Arctic air hits much of the U.S., Associated Press, Chicago. A blast of the season's first frigid air bore down on much of the U.S. on Monday, bringing the prospect of snow to parts of the country and plunging temperatures in Florida, though it may not get cold enough there for iguanas to tumble from the treetops. National Weather Service forecasters said frigid Arctic air will pour into the eastern two-thirds of the country, bringing with it the chance for record low temperatures in the U.S. southeast, including all of Florida, where temperatures in parts of the state were near 80 degrees Fahrenheit just a day ago. The cold air will reach the Great Plains on Monday, bringing gusty winds and red flag warnings in the region, according to forecasters, and the Great Lakes and Appalachian Mountains regions would see 4 to 8 inches. Around Lake Erie, forecasters warned about the prospect of lake effect snow, which occurs in relatively narrow bands that dump copious amounts of snow. It's a phenomenon that can be drastically increase snowfall totals that could hit one area but miss another not far away untouched. In Florida, forecasters say the wind chill will be in the 30s Fahrenheit. During previous cold periods, iguanas, an invasive reptile species, have gone into sort of suspended animation and fallen to the ground when the temperatures dip below 40 degrees. they usually wake up with the sun's warmth. Meteorologists had said conditions for road travel in northeast Illinois would be dangerous to impossible from snow accumulating faster than 3 inches per hour. As temperatures dropped across the nation's midsection, meteorologists warned of hazardous travel conditions through winter weather advisories for Michigan, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Snow fell Sunday in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, where meteorologists warned of low visibility with up to a foot of snow by Monday. In Indiana, weather experts predicted up to 11 inches of snow and slippery surfaces for road travel. Up to 6 inches of snow were predicted in parts of Wisconsin. Patchy blowing snow and wind chills hovering near zero were expected in portions of Minnesota, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Some areas got measurable fluff a day earlier, including 4 inches of snow in southwest Minnesota and more than 5 inches in slices of northern Iowa. Cold weather warnings were issued for Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky, with freezing temperatures predicted through Monday morning for a large swath of the South, from Texas and Oklahoma to Alabama and Georgia. Weather experts issued special guidance for gardeners, saying the freeze warnings mean the growing season has ended. Take steps now to protect tender plants from the cold, warned meteorologists in Arkansas. And the photo here is a medium-sized color photo. A car is covered with snow Sunday during a cold day in Evanston, Illinois. We're looking at it head-on, looking at the hood, windshield wipers, and windshield, and then the roof with its roof rail racks covered in snow, and looks like a scattering of leaves as well. No photo credit, though. From the State House, leaks a Springfield tradition that will not be going away. Rich Miller. Rich Miller publishes Capital Facts, a daily political newsletter, and CapitalFacts.com. House Democratic legislators received a stern lecture during the second week of veto session about leaks from their private party caucus meetings. During the first week of veto session in October, I posted a photo of my blog of a caucus PowerPoint presentation showing the range of revenue ideas under consideration in the House to fund mass transit while the caucus was still meeting. That apparently caused quite a stir. Then at the beginning of the veto session's second week, I posted a narrative from the caucus meeting about the House Democratic revenue plan for mass transit, again, while the caucus was still meeting. That turned out to be the final straw. Leadership quickly clamped down. Staff members were dispersed throughout State House Hearing Room 114, where the majority party caucus meetings have traditionally been held. During a subsequent caucus meeting to keep an eye on members' mobile phone usage, members were told that leakers would be invited to not caucus with us anymore, according to a participant. And if the leaks continued and the culprits weren't caught, duly elected House members were warned they'd be required to check their mobile phones at the door. I've dealt with this sort of thing for as long as I've been writing about the legislature, but it hasn't made me stop. I realized long ago that much of the real business of the state legislature was conducted, or at least openly discussed, behind closed doors during party caucus meetings. If you wanted to know what was happening or what was about to happen, it seemed obvious to me that a good way of doing that was to find out what was happening at those meetings. Almost nobody liked the idea, except for my readers. Caucus meetings are supposedly a place where legislators can express thoughts that they can't or won't say in public. I get that, but it's not my problem. Plus, I admit, the cloak and dagger tactics I sometimes have to use to obtain this information can often be fun. House Speaker Michael Madigan's people were furious whenever I wrote about what went on behind closed doors in the 1990s. I was having dinner with my parents at a Springfield restaurant when a person close to then-Senate President Phil Rock angrily berated me for writing about the sacred caucus meetings we've long since made up. Senate President Pate Phillip threatened to eject members from the SGOP caucus for leaking to me, which I, of course, wrote about the next day. Pate was convinced that then-Senator Judy Bar Topinka was my source, but little did he know that one of his favorites was my main backup. That person is still alive, so I won't mention his name. Senate President Emil Jones not only threatened to kick members out of his caucus for leaking to me, but he also threatened members of his own leadership team with ejection for talking to me about their high-level, high-stakes meetings about Speaker Madigan's feud with Governor Rod Blagojevich. Eventually, things mostly chilled out. Madigan stopped holding regular caucus meetings for a time, but he eventually grew to at least grudgingly accept the leaks. Both Senate Presidents John Cullerton and Don Harmon decided not to make a big deal about it. I kind of chuckled when I heard about the recent attempt at intimidating elected Illinois representatives because those two veto session House Democratic caucus leaks didn't come to me directly from members. House members were texting lobbyists who, as loyal subscribers, forwarded those texts to me. I confirmed their authenticity and published them. It's been my experience that human beings love sharing information, even, and often especially, when they're told not to. And it's not like these are nuclear weapon secrets or something. It's state government, not the CIA. Also, the contents of that photo of House revenue options ended up in the legislative constitution surveys not long after the caucus meeting. The Illinois Policy Institute published screenshots of one of those surveys the same day I posted the photo. And the revenue list I posted during the second week was made public just hours later when the House unveiled its doomed mass transit bill. As Elvis Costello once sang, I used to be disgusted, and now I try to be amused. Moving on to The Nation and World, it's called E-Edition Plus. Obergefell versus Hodges, marriage decision stands. Justices rebuff appeal from former clerk who wouldn't issue licenses. Mark Sherman, Associated Press, Washington. The Supreme Court rejected a call Monday to overturn its landmark decision that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. The justices, without comment, turned away an appeal from Kim Davis, a former Kentucky court clerk, who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples after the High Court's 2015 ruling in Obergefell v. Hodges. Davis had been trying to get the court to overturn a lower court order for her to pay $360,000 in damages and attorney's fees to a couple denied a marriage license. Her lawyers repeatedly invoked the words of Justice Clarence Thomas, who, alone among the nine justices, called for erasing the same-sex marriage ruling. Thomas was among four dissenting justices in 2015. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito are the other dissenters who remain on the court today. Roberts has been silent on the subject since he wrote a dissenting opinion in the case. Alito continues to criticize the decision, but he said recently he doesn't advocate that it be overturned. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who was not on the court in 2015, said that there are times when the court should correct mistakes and overturn decisions, as it did in the 2022 case that ended a constitutional right to abortion. But Barrett suggested recently that same-sex marriage might be in a different category than abortion because people relied on the decision when they married and had children. Human Rights Campaign President Kelly Robinson praised the justice's decision not to intervene. The Supreme Court made clear today that refusing to respect the constitutional rights of others does not come without consequences, Robinson said in a statement. Davis drew national attention to eastern Kentucky's Rowan County when she turned away same-sex couples, claiming her faith prevented her from complying with the high court ruling. She defied court orders to issue the licenses until a federal judge jailed her for contempt of court in September 2015. She was released after her staff issued the licenses on her behalf but removed her name from the form. The Kentucky legislature later enacted a law removing the names of all county clerks from state marriage licenses. Davis lost a re-election bid in 2018. Briefly, ceasefire U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner met Monday with Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss the next stages of the fragile Gaza ceasefire while Israel returned the remains of another 15 Palestinians. D.C. deployment. A judge on Monday allowed the continued deployment of more than 300 West Virginia National Guard members to patrol the streets of Washington, D.C. as part of the President Donald Trump's push to send the military into Democratic-run cities. West Virginia is among several states that sent National Guard members to the nation's capital. BBC. President Donald Trump threatened legal action Monday against the BBC over the way the speech he made on January 6, 2021 was edited in a documentary aired by Britain's national broadcaster. BBC Chairman Samir Shah apologized Monday for the, quote, error of judgment, unquote, which triggered the resignations of the BBC's top executive and its head of news. Florida. A small turboprop plane on a hurricane relief mission to Jamaica crashed Monday morning in a gated residential neighborhood of the Fort Lauderdale suburb of Coral Springs, killing two people shortly after takeoff, authorities said. Clemency. Convicted drug dealer Jonathan Braun, who was granted clemency by President Donald Trump, was sent back to federal prison Monday for violating the terms of his release after being charged with several new crimes. India. A car explosion Monday near the historic Red Fort, India's capital of New Delhi, killed eight people and injured at least 19 others, police said. The cause of the blast is under investigation. Trump hosts al-Shara in first-ever meeting Syrian leader at White House for 2 hours, then greets supporters. Associated Press, Washington. President Donald Trump hosted Syrian President Ahmad al-Shara on Monday at the White House, welcoming the once pariah state into the U.S.-led global coalition to fight the Islamic State group. Al-Shara arrived at the White House shortly, or about 11:30 a.m., and shortly after began his Oval Office meeting, which was closed to the media. The Syrian president entered the building through the West Executive Avenue next to the White House, rather than on the West Wing driveway, normally used for foreign leaders' arrivals. He left the White House about 2 hours later and greeted a throng of supporters gathered outside. "We'll do everything we can to make Syria successful because that's part of the Middle East," Trump told reporters Monday. The U.S. president said of al-Shara that, "I have confidence that he'll be able to do the job." It marked the first visit to the White House by a Syrian head of state since the Middle Eastern country gained independence from France in 1946, and comes after the U.S. lifted sanctions imposed on Syria during the decades the country was ruled by the Assad family. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for this Veterans Day, November 11th, 2025. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.